Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'll talk today about some recent work we're doing trying to incorporate hydrologic complexity into some watershed scale models. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Amy Kollek from the ARS and Dan Fuca from Virginia Tech as well. So first, how is management at the watershed scale evaluated? Well, generally we use models to do this. And unfortunately, with a lot of the current models we use, the management is based on the land use. So you know, you have agriculture 0 to 100%, and that influences your total P loss at the watershed scale. Forest has less total phosphorus loss than agricultural land. Now, unfortunately, if land use is your only variable, your management options are extremely limited. So I think as a result, we've sometimes really developed non-point source pollution control strategies based on specific land uses, so either corn or pasture, and not on the interaction between land management and these physical landscape scale processes. So we'd like to be able to develop practices where we can apply manure to the bulk of this field and not in these critical source areas where the runoff is being generated. And so some of the background in terms of the modeling, most of these models use the hydrologic response unit, or HRU. And so most of the models define this hydrologic response unit as the coincidence of soil and land use. And so your hydrological and chemical properties are defined at this HRU level. And unfortunately, with this conceptualization, you know, runoff versus phosphorus loss would be the same from a lowland pasture as it would from an upland pasture if they have the same soil type and land use. There's really no way to distinguish where these HRUs are in this watershed based solely on land use and soil type. Unfortunately, I think that's a pretty bad assumption in a lot of the landscapes in these humid temperate climates. You can see in this pasture, there's some pretty differing hydrologic responses. One is a very high runoff generating area, and one might be fine. You could probably apply manure to the top of that hill slope and not run into a water quality problem, where you'd like to avoid manure application in that saturated area. So we'd like to be able to tease these out with our models, be able to identify these areas. So I have a couple rules that I set up for when we start working with new models. First, we need to consider spatially distributed properties other than simply land use and soils. You know, be able to identify specific areas of these fields where we can target management. We need to account for locations of features, you know, pollutant sources, relative to hydrologically active areas, avoid manure application to saturated source areas near a stream. And we'd like to minimize or ideally eliminate model calibration. Use the best data available we have to initialize and parameterize this model and reduce our calibration efforts. So I'll give a little bit of background, some simplified hydrology for the work that we're doing. Now we have a hillside here, and we have a floodplain or valley bottom where you find the streams. In a lot of the areas we're working, particularly in Chesapeake Bay and humid temperate northeast, we have a shallow bedrock or fragipan or other type of restricting layer that tends to perch water and causes lateral flow down these hill slopes into these saturated or these valley bottom areas. And then we get base flow from the valley bottom and hillside drainage from that hill slope contributing to stream flow. Now the common perception of runoff in a lot of these modeling senses is that you get rain falling on this hill slope, a fraction of that rainfall infiltrates the soil, and a corresponding fraction ends up as runoff. And this is an infiltration excess runoff process, or Hortonian flow, developed by Robert Horton in the 30s and 40s. And a lot of the watershed models that we work with use the curve number, which is based on this theory of infiltration excess runoff generation. So we asked, is Hortonian flow common? Again, this is from the Chesapeake Bay, where a lot of our work is based. And we're showing here simply the percent of the area generating Hortonian flow on the y-axis, and the return period, storm return period, on the x-axis. And really what you can see is during the time of the year when we get the bulk of our precipitation, that is fall through spring, 70% of precipitation falls during that period, Hortonian flow or infiltration excess runoff is exceedingly rare. You know, you have to get above sort of a 10-year return period storm to really see any of the percent of the watershed area generating Hortonian flow. You do get some Hortonian flow or infiltration excess runoff being generated during these intense convective-type storms in the summer, where we exceed the infiltration capacity of the soil for short durations of time. But again, it's not that common in a lot of the areas that we're working in. I'm not saying, you know, Texas or Oklahoma or these high clay soils would do it, but a lot of the other areas, this is pretty typical. So what is creating runoff? We are getting runoff from these watersheds. Well, we've done a lot of work that's shown it's a saturation excess runoff phenomenon. So again, you have this same hill slope, you have rain falling in this hill slope, and now if the soil has available storage capacity above that restricting layer, it can infiltrate that rainfall. And what it does is it causes the subsurface water table or the available water content of the soil to rise. So you get a saturated area forming across that hill slope. Now, some of these areas saturate to the surface, and any rain on these saturated areas becomes overland flow or runoff. Now, we can add some complexity by adding this interflow. So upland interflow, so rain that's infiltrated in that hill slope, upslope, can flow laterally over that restricting layer and exfiltrate in these saturated source areas. So it's a little bit more complex than simply rain on saturated areas becoming overland flow. And these are what we call variable source areas. And maybe you can't see it in this picture, but this field, you can see some saturated areas at the bottoms of these slopes that tend to produce runoff. And that's when we get water quality degradation occurring. These flow paths connect saturated areas and can transport the contaminants to our water bottoms. And just some more pictures of this phenomenon. Again, this is relatively common in much of the eastern U.S. Now, unfortunately, most of these watershed models that we're using were never intended to capture this complexity. They work very well with what they're intended to do, and that is predict watershed-level export of flows and contaminants. They were never really intended to be applied at the field scale, which is what we're doing with these models more and more often these days. And there's lots of SWOT, GBLF, AGNEPS, HSPF, all of these really use that same theory behind them. So a lot of our work has dealt with trying to, I don't want to say fix these models because they're not broken, they do well what they were supposed to do, but apply them to different agroecosystem environments. And I said, like I said before, the curve number is really the backbone of runoff generation in a lot of these models. And all the curve number is it says that runoff is a function of the effective precipitation squared divided by the effective precipitation plus storage. Now, you know, the curve number is based on thousands of field years of runoff plot data. So there is a lot of data behind this relatively simple model, and it works in a lot of environments. And everyone calls it an empirical model, and it is for the most part, but there is some physicality behind it. You can imagine that effective precipitation and storage are physical parameters. These are things we can go out and measure to some extent in our watersheds. The problem is that the way the curve number is applied, we take these physical parameters, for instance, storage, and relate it to the curve number by this simple empirical equation. And all this does is it uses a table to link this curve number to land use and soil drainage class. So you're taking something that does have some physicality to it and really abstracted it into just a lookup table. So I'm calling this curve numbering variable source area hydrology. So we want to try and go back to some of the original curve number work and add back that physicality into how the curve number is applied in these watersheds. And again, this is the curve number here. Q is runoff. And in this simplified watershed, you have an area that's saturated and an area that's unsaturated. Now, if you get precipitation falling in this watershed, it falls in an unsaturated area, it doesn't create a response that we can measure at the watershed outlet. What it does is it changes the moisture content of that area of the watershed, but we don't generate runoff from that area. If it falls in an area that's saturated, we get a response, in this case, stream flow or excess water that we can measure leaving the watershed. So for my PhD, we basically showed that we can interpret the curve number in a variable source area concept by assuming that, again, rain falling in unsaturated area infiltrates and rain falling in a saturated area produces a response. And in this case, if we differentiate the curve number with respect to effective precipitation, we can come up with a relationship for the fraction of the watershed area that's generating runoff for a given storage and a given storm. And that's this relationship right here. So all this relationship says is that runoff is only generated from areas of the watershed that have a local effective storage less than or equal to the effective precipitation. So that is, when you get rain falling on this watershed, if the local storage of any given point in that watershed is less than or equal to the effective precipitation, it's going to create runoff. So we just replace that P sub E with a sigma sub E, which is the local effective storage for any given fractional area of the watershed. And just rearranging, so now we have a relationship for the specific area of a watershed that generates runoff for an overall watershed storage value. So long story short, if we think of it conceptually, we have this area of the watershed, thickness of equals 1, which is the lowest storage area of the watershed. We get, when that equals 0, no more storage available, any rain falling in that area of the watershed produces the rainfall that fell on it. Similarly, the next driest area of the watershed, sigma sub 2 equals 0, when that equals 0, no more storage, you get a response equal to the effective precipitation that fell on that area of the watershed. And we can go up the watershed all the way to the most unsaturated area of the watershed. So long story short, if we know something about the storage capacity of that watershed and the effective precipitation, again, things that we can measure to some extent, we can come up with the fraction of the watershed generating runoff, the local fraction of the area generating runoff, and the total fraction of the area generating runoff. Unfortunately, you know, we know how much area is contributing and how much runoff has been generated, but we don't know from where in the watershed. Where is it coming from? That's what we'd really like to know to target management practices across these watersheds. So what we then do is we introduce some terrain modeling. In this case, we use a topographic index to basically distribute our predictions across this watershed. And the topographic index is simply a function you calculate in a GIS. It's the natural log of the upslope contributing area divided by the tangent of the slope. So if you think back to Darcy's law, when your slope flattens, you can conduct less water through that profile, so you're more likely to perch water and saturate. Likewise, if you have a large upslope contributing area through any given point, you have to channel more runoff or more subsurface flow through that point to be more likely to saturate and generate runoff. So again, this is a continuum. In this watershed, there were over 72 million individual topographic index values. So we dumb it down a little bit and say, okay, we're going to make 10 index classes across this watershed. So 10 is the most wet, these blue areas, and 1 is one of the driest areas or most storage across this watershed. And then all we do is relate those local storages to these wetness index classes across the watershed, like that. And you'll notice that the sum of all those local storage values have to equal that overall watershed storage value. So it comes back to that knowing something about that watershed, global watershed storage, we can start to distribute across a watershed now. So operationally, how we include it in the model is we simply, now we embed the soil properties, because in this case, SWAT needs all the soil properties that in that database. We embed those in the topographic index metric we've created, and then do the same thing. We create our HRUs as the coincidence of topographic index and land use. So now, runoff and phosphorus losses are not the same in lowland pasture and upland pasture because they have a different topographic control on their runoff generation. And I ask, is this a better assumption? Well, perhaps. So some results. So for stream flow, what you notice here is that at the watershed outlet, there's really no difference between a variable source area conceptualization and a standard conceptualization. They both use the curve number. They use it differently. But at the watershed outlet, you can't tell the difference between the two models. They both predict the stream flow with equal skill. However, you can see some differences in the spatial distribution of where runoff is generated if you look at the two models, the VSA versus the standard version. In the VSA version, runoff is primarily controlled by the topographic index, that is, where you are in a terrain sense in that watershed. Well, in the standard model, it's controlled primarily by land use. For instance, the blue, the high runoff areas in the standard model are almost all corn. So it doesn't differentiate from where you are in the landscape. So I'll zoom in here really quick and we'll look at some sort of hill slope level predictions of what's occurring in this watershed. And so, again, you'll see here this is a map of the topographic index across the hill slope here. Blue areas are wetter, like more likely to saturate and generate runoff. Red areas are drier. What we did is we measured the shallow water table above a restricting layer with a nest of piezometers. That's the black and the yellow dots across this hill slope over a season. And I'll play a video briefly here. And what you're going to see is that these areas with a large upslope contributing area that sort of channel through any given cell of this watershed tend to get more saturated, whereas areas that are steeper slope or have a low contributing area tend not to saturate as quickly. And this is, in fact, what our model predicts. You can see the prediction sort of aggregated here over this season for the VSA version versus the standard version. So again, we show it across index classes here and land use in the standard version. What you see is that the topographic index version, or the VSA version, tends to capture the temporal evolution of that shallow water table better than the standard version simply based on land use. Again, in this watershed, at least, topography that's driving the hydrologic response and not the specific land use. So what about for phosphorus? So we're concerned with, in these watersheds, phosphorus loss. Well, now you see here some interesting results. So for the VSA version, we get pretty good predictions of watershed level export of phosphorus from this basin. Whereas with the standard version, we're not able to predict the temporal evolution of phosphorus export from this watershed with nearly the skill of the VSA version. And I think this is because we're better capturing the runoff source areas with the variable source area version compared to the standard version simply based on land use. And again, if you look at the spatial distribution of phosphorus hotspots or source areas in this watershed, again, we see some pretty dramatic differences. With the VSA version, again, corn does tend to be a phosphorus hotspot, but not all corn fields contribute to the same phosphorus loss across this watershed. Whereas in the standard version, again, those highest phosphorus loss areas are simply a function of corn land use. So we can't differentiate and apply management with nearly the same targeting we could if we looked at the standard version versus the variable source area version. So some key messages. I think identifying your dominant source areas are a critical first step to correctly characterizing your watershed. So before we even go in there and model anything, we really need to know what we're trying to model. What is the dominant hydrologic process that's occurring? Where are these dominant source areas occurring? And then we can go in and try and pick the right model or select the right model to get at what we want to get at. So really, I think we're trying to incorporate process features or patterns that really have some physical meaning and are scalable or scale invariant into our watershed models. And we need to better account for this in one of the other models that we're using. And finally, hydrologic complexity, I think, can simplify watershed modeling, producing a model that's better answer pertinent questions. So, you know, climate change and land use management are big questions that we're facing in the next, you know, coming decades. So I think that we need to account for these fine scale features across the watershed and to answer those questions. You know, what is the impact of, you know, climate change on nutrient cycling? It's not going to be the same across the watershed. It's going to differ based on where you are in that watershed. And I think we need to account for that in a more mechanistic sense in a lot of these models. And so that's all I have. I guess I finished in time. So
that's perfect. Yeah.
If there's any questions.
Thank you very much. And we have about 2 minutes for questions, so plenty of time.
How big was your watershed, and what kind of efforts you need to characterize all the area that's input?
So the watershed here was 37 square kilometers. We've applied it to 179,000 square kilometer watershed as well. So it's scalable. That's what I was talking about. You can scale these features across the watershed. And what you need, if you were just going to take a standard SWOT model, what you need in addition to that is the terrain metric component of it. And so you basically have everything you need already. It's just manipulating the terrain differently. So you take the DEM and use the DEM in a different sense.
Nope. Don't you think that the importance of the variable source area will be a function of the rainfall intensity and the land use? And right now it looks to me like it's so dominated by the topography that you lose that sophistication.
Well, land use is certainly important for the chemistry. You have to have that land use component in there.
I said, I'm talking about the runoff. Just restrict ourselves to the runoff.
Sure. Well, I probably made it sound like that, but that's not actually the case operationally in the model, because land use is important for the evapotranspiration component. But again, we're talking about well-vegetated environments that...
Right, but I thought you would want to make it land use independent. I mean, your example was shrubs and trees and mm-hmm. pastures.
Sure.
All of those are well-vegetated.
Right. Well, that's sort of one of the caveats of the model. You need to be in a well-vegetated environment. You couldn't use this in an arid environment. I wouldn't use it in an urban environment. Things like that.
So, go ahead.
So I really like the idea, but I think it's a little, we need a hybrid.
Sure.